Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Founders Club Radio.
Welcome to the Founders Club, where each week we talk to the founders and leaders of great private companies. I'm your host, John Coffin, and I'm thrilled this morning to be joined here in the studio by Ted Benning, the president of Benning Construction Company, and Chip Matthews, the president of two companies, Air Van, Inc., and Duval Semi-Trailers. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Chip, I'm going to start with you. I'd love to know a little bit more about both of your companies, Air Van and DST, we'll call it, or Duval Semi-Trailers. Tell us about both those businesses.
All right. The first one is, let's talk about Air Van. Air Van is a business that was started by my father back in the early 50s. It is an air freight forwarding company based in Jacksonville, Florida. It does customs clearance, warehousing. It deconsolidates and consolidates shipments to and from Puerto Rico, does final mile delivery, white glove delivery, things like that down in Jacksonville, Florida. It has a division called AVI Logistics, which is a brokerage firm. We broker truckloads around the United States. We started that business in September of 2013, which is the logistics side, and made our first profit 2 months ago.
Great. Congratulations.
Hallelujah. Yeah, that's always good fun job. To finally get over the hump.
That's a pretty quick investment cycle for a new company
a
new division.
It was.
Right.
But the base business of Air Van has been very steady for many years, not a lot of debt. We use owner-operators for the deliveries. So anyway, great little business that has just grown over time with the International Airport in Jacksonville. DST is a business that is completely different. It's around trucking, but we started that when I lived in Jacksonville, Florida, and that's why we named it Duval Semi-Trailers. And what we do is we lease, rent, maintain over-the-road trailers, like tractor trailers, but just the back part, the trailer. And we found a niche in that market. We started out just simply renting storage trailers back in the 80s. My wife at the time was my girlfriend, and we were dating, and we came up with this idea, and we started buying old trailers and renting them out. And she always gets mad at me because in the early days, she would have to come to the shop and help paint wheels and undercarriages, and I ruined her fancy shoes. And she always says I never replaced her shoes. And
somehow, I don't believe that.
Yeah, you know, somewhere along the way, yeah. I think I have. But anyway, that business grew to about 75 trailers, and my father transferred me back to Atlanta when I was working for the family trucking business. And so I had to sell the business, and he said, I'll buy it. So I sold it to my father, and it rocked on along for about 10 years, and no one really managed it well. So I approached him about buying it back, and I bought it back in 2000, and we found another sort of niche in the market and ran with it. Real short, fun story. The young man was running the day-to-day operation, and he walked in one day, and he said, do you know what a cartage trailer is? And I said, yeah. And he goes, tell me. And I said, well, it's a trailer you rent. Instead of being a storage trailer, it's an over-the-road trailer, but they use it around town. He said, well, I got a good friend of mine I go to church with, and he needs a bunch. And I said, well, good. I said, we can do that. And I said, who's he work for? And he says, FedEx. And I said, oh. And I said, how many does he need? And he goes, I don't know. I'll find out. So he calls him. Lo and behold, he needed a lot of trailers. And so we went out and supplied FedEx, which was our really first big customer. And literally people started calling us saying, do you have any more? And we said, sure, we'll go get more. And the business just took off.
And so today, the number of trailers that you own and are renting out are how many?
When in 2000, when we bought the business back, there were about 300 trailers in the fleet. Today, we have just shy of 3,100.
3,100, incredible.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, that's in that fleet.
10x growth, that's just remarkable.
Yeah, yeah.
And I guess because of those niche opportunities, you've also expanded from your Atlanta headquarters to different markets. How did you decide to do that?
So our largest accounts are people like FedEx and Saia and other large trucking companies, and they have distribution centers in large distribution towns like Memphis and Dallas, and they needed help in those areas. So we opened in Memphis and Dallas. Our next location is going to be Charlotte. We're opening it next year, and then after that will be St. Louis. But we have national contracts with these larger accounts and companies now, and so they say, you know, we walk in the door and say, we're here, and they say, we need this many. And it's
so you've really seeded that new geographic area with one or two key clients, and then I guess over time you build around that. Has that typically been your strategy
for geographic expansion? That has been it. We have – you asked me not to do this, but I'm going to do this. We really needed a great banking partner, and I called John Coffin on the phone one day and on a Sunday night and said, I got this little business, and it's – growing like a weed, and I need help. And so lo and behold, John Coffin jumped in and really helped us out. So I want to say thank you for that.
Well, thank you. We appreciate the free plug. There you go. But, you know, you've mentioned kind of these opportunities that just kind of arise. Talk about that a little bit, because sometimes it's obvious, like, gosh, FedEx, but sometimes it's more of a gut instinct type of thing. Any observations on you know, kind of how you take advantage of that next opportunity?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, we sort of started into this storage trailer business and didn't know exactly where we were going with it, but knew there was a need there. And the real niche presented itself. And when it did, you sort of look at it and you go, you know what? I don't know that anybody's doing that. So there's other trailer rental companies out there. But what we found is nobody tailored to the LTL industry, the less than truckload industry, which needs a little bit different trailer. It has to have a roll-up door. They do want it a little bit shorter. And so that's what we did. We went and found trailers, converted them to roll-up doors, had to make them spotless because an LTL carrier has got 20 different customers on one trailer. That trailer breaks down, and it really is a problem. So these things have to be flawless. Mm. And so when we put out a trailer, it was freshly painted. It was really in good shape, and that's why people called us.
So I guess the other key issue of this, of your business, is this whole capital expenditure of investing constantly in trailers, keeping your fleet up to date. But how do you make through different cycles those CapEx decisions? You know, 3,000 trailers is a remarkable amount of just raw equipment that you have out there.
So the big key to that whole game is you have to be proactive. You've got to stay ahead of it. When you see it coming, you feel it coming, you better get your spreadsheets ready and project it out and sit down with the bank and say, this is what we're seeing and this is what we expect. And in the early days, it's very hard because you really don't have the numbers to back you up. So you've got to have a good partner that understands what you're trying to accomplish. But once you sort of go through the first cycle and everything you say is going to happen does happen, mm-hmm. everybody starts believing you, then each time it gets a little easier, a little easier, a little easier. Everybody understands each other. And then the next thing you know, you got 3,000 trailers running up and down the road.
Right. Fantastic. Being president of two companies has got to be interesting. You probably feel like you divide your time in different ways, but how do you personally manage that? I guess there's an aspect of that for every business owner in that they're paying attention to perhaps two parts of their business or, in your instance, two separate businesses. How do you do it?
And I heard on another Founders Club radio show, and this is so true, is it is all about finding the right guy or girl that understands the vision as well as you or better than you, that has the drive and the motivation and the want. We call it the want. If you got the want, you can do anything. Where mm-hmm. there's a will, there's a way. And you find that person. Sometimes it takes going through a couple before you find them that has the right motivation. But when they do, that is the whole key. There's no way I could do this by myself. I have to have, or we have to have, somebody that's driving it as hard as I, or even harder. In terms of DST, the gentleman that runs that business on a day-to-day business, on a day-to-day basis, is driven, I think, more than I. So.
And I guess you so that's really a recruiting aspect for an individual or a team, but it's also a retention side of things. And I guess that's critical, I guess, just to have your hands in the business enough so that you really know what the primary motivators for your team is.
Absolutely. So then employment contracts that, you know, with DST, we didn't start with one, but now we have one that took about a year to negotiate, which was, you know, I couldn't believe it took that long. But at the end of the day, he's happy, I'm happy. It secures our longevity, and he feels very secure long-term with the business.
And, you know, one of the things I hear about in the transportation and logistics business generally is that employee turnover is just very high. How do you kind of create the kind of culture that people want to stick around and be a part of?
Yeah, the hard part of that is you've got to get your message out, and the message has got to be very clear. I really believe in incentive plans, but the incentive plans have to be simple. They have to be understandable by the guy that's receiving it, and it has to be hard and fast. There cannot be any gray area. So when the end of the month, when the P&L comes out, I don't calculate the incentive. The CFO does, and there's no, well, maybe this or maybe that. It's a hard number. The employees see it. You know, my opinion is you can't play a football game without a scoreboard.
Mm-hmm.
The employees cannot run a company unless they see the P&L. So when it comes out, they see it the same day I see it. And it's the measure of success. Are we succeeding or are they not? And they get to benefit. They get to participate in it.
So that that bottom line for you is the scoreboard for your employees.
It's all about making a profit.
That's a great point, because a lot of companies are not quite as transparent about that. And there's some benefits to doing that at times. But it sounds like you've benefited from that transparency.
Yeah,
great. Ted, I'm going to switch to you. You know, as I was driving here, and I think I probably passed numerous of Benning Construction's incredible projects over the years. Tell us about the scope of your current business, and then I'd love to kind of go back in time a little bit, because you really have been critical to the growth of the city of Atlanta and the Southeast. But tell us about Benning today first.
Well, that's kind that you give us that much credit, which we probably don't deserve. I would say that right now our work is primarily involved in new retail construction, multi-screen theater, some self-storage facilities, some government sector work, and we're working from Raleigh, North Carolina, down to Tampa, Florida, and across over to Huntsville and Memphis and Atlanta and on down the line. So we've got a series of projects we're running right now, somewhere in the neighborhood of 35 projects at a time.
Is that a full load for you typically, or 35 projects?
Well, what we try to do is to take a look at where we've been in the past and where we're going to go in the future. Hmm. Under current loading, we are near capacity. Our capacity is not so much, it is defined by a number of qualified personnel that can run the work, but also the number of qualified superintendents, the number of qualified subcontractors and material vendors. We found that one of the results of the Great Reset or the Great Recession was management capacity was diminished in our subcontractor and vendor base. Worker capacity was relocated and displaced to where construction activity was going on, which is in the Dakotas, mm-hmm. in Louisiana and Texas. And so we currently have a tremendous shortage of trained personnel in which to execute work. We also have a shortage of qualified suppliers. Mm-hmm. The equipment manufacturers, whether it be air conditioning equipment, electrical fixtures, plumbing fixtures, have not brought lines back into production again. And so they've experienced growing pains in trying to reopen lines. And so the quality of the products that they put out have somewhat diminished, which increase inspection problems for us on the back end, where we have a diminished base. So we're in a little bit of a cycle now where too much work is bad.
Right. So you have to perhaps throttle back a little bit in order to maintain your quality standards.
That's right. And we've experienced, I always say that we're not all that unique in the construction business. I can look at the general economy and I can look at our revenues, and we go up and down with the tide, mm-hmm. just like everybody else does. We've had a really, really good relationship with a lot of long-term customers who saw us through the recession and continue to see us through these times now. But it is very, very tough to sit down with a key customer and say, I know you want to do this deal in February, but you're going to do yourself a favor by waiting till June. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And a lot of folks don't want to hear that.
Right. So your great-grandfather, I guess, came to Atlanta after being a captain of a ship in the Pacific Rim, and he got involved in building and construction, and then four generations, you're involved. Tell us about that. Tell us about the evolution of a family business.
Well, I think every time we look at our company and we look at the family history, we reinvent ourselves every 5 years. Mm. So when I go back to my great-grandfather and how he got here and why he got here, which is a story in and of itself, which is very interesting in family circles, but probably not very interesting to anybody else. He was here post-Reconstruction. Mm-hmm. His father was from the South. He was sent overseas during the Civil War. And so he joined the British Merchant Marine, and as the family like to say, he plied the China trade and came back to Atlanta with a suitcase full of money and ready to start building. And mm-hmm. so he was part of Reconstruction and, of course, started some construction downtown and was part of the Atlanta Reconstruction efforts between the 1880s and the 1900s. He wanted my grandfather to be a professional. He could be a doctor, he could be a lawyer, he could be an architect. And my grandfather didn't like lawyers, and he didn't want to be a doctor, so he became an architect. So when he graduated from architectural school from Auburn in 1913, he went up to work for Pocahontas Fuel Company in Bluefield, West Virginia, as a mine engineer. Fell in love with construction, and so he and his brother founded the original Benning Construction Company in the 20s. They did real, real well until the Great Depression, mm-hmm. and they got wiped out. Mm. So fast forward, my father was a decorated war hero. They came back to the Atlanta market. My grandfather and father always had a vision to refound the company, and in 1953 they did that. I was born in 1954 and went on the payroll soon in 1955.
So whether you wanted to do something else in your life or not, you didn't have a choice, it sounds like.
I had choices, but I was encouraged to do what I'm doing. I was fortunate to be trained by some really wonderful people. Mm-hmm. There's a joy being in a family business and being around family members, where when you're a kid, you come home from school and you take your school books and you load up the dogs and you go over to your dad's office, which is 1,000 feet away, and you go and you walk into the middle of a meeting with some high-powered executive and you ask your grandfather for a dime or a quarter, and then you trot yourself and the dogs out of the room and they all go back to work again. But it was that kind of familiar situation, and it was wonderful. Mm-hmm. When I was in my teenage years, my grandfather and father knew that they couldn't do anything with me, and so they turned me over to their field superintendents to kick me into line and sent me out of town. And so as a 13- and 14-year-old being on construction crews in Thomasville, Georgia, and Cartersville, Georgia, and being away from home, you get to see some things that perhaps 13-, 14-, 15-year-olds shouldn't see, but it gave me a perspective on the psychological or social basis of how construction works, which was a wonderful benefit to understand that how people think in the executive offices and how people think in the field offices is somewhat different. Mm. The value equation is different.
Right. So you mentioned the reinvention and reinventing the business every 5 years. There's also this cultural cornerstones that are part of a firm. What are some of the cornerstones that you've created or that have just been there for nearly 100 years now?
Well, I think one of the key aspects, which has always been there, is that we believe in making a profit, and we believe in fair contracts. Mm-hmm. So one of the cornerstones has always been fairness, mm-hmm. and making money.
Right.
And those aren't mutually exclusive. I think trying to deal with people on a fair and equitable basis. We're in a highly litigious business in construction. People like to sue each other in construction. we've been able to avoid a whole lot of that. We haven't been completely free of that, but I can count on two hands the number of lawsuits we've had in the last 62 years, and that includes subcontractors, material vendors, and owners. And so we're very, very pleased with that kind of record. So how does that happen? Well, it happens by fair dealings and being tough but fair with everybody that we do business with. So that's a cornerstone. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, we're now working toward our fourth and fifth generation. And we ask our next generation to define a moral statement for what they saw the company's vision to be. And they said that they believe in the moral value of hard work. So I think that's a cornerstone.
Right.
A definite cornerstone for
us. Well, and that's something that your whole team can embrace, which is fantastic. That's universal, whether you're on the project pouring concrete or you're running the company.
That's right. And it's something that I think everybody wants to have dignity and value in the work they do, whether mm-hmm. they're pushing a broom or whether they're wiring a light fixture or whether they're figuring out how to do profit and loss statements.
So recently you've made the decision to go from a purely family firm to an ESOP. Mm-hmm. And tell us about that decision, because ESOPs have waxed and waned in favor, and they're really coming back these days as a important tool for continuity within great private companies. Mm-hmm. Could you speak to ESOPs for a little bit?
Sure. The ESOP decision, we first considered in 2001. My two kids, who are a lot older than I want to say right now, and they're getting older every day, I'm not, but they are, were very, very clear to me that professor. So both of them said, Dad, we're just not coming in. So that posed the question for both my dad and myself, what do we do with a closely held family corporation when the next generation of bloodline does not want to come into the company? So we had three or four different options. We could merge, mm-hmm. we could sell out, we could do an ESOP, or we could do nothing.
Right.
So we looked at an ESOP in 2001, saw the benefits of it, but realized we weren't ready. Fast forward to 2006, we said, we're going to do this. Mm-hmm. 2007, we pulled the trigger on the first third of the company going into the employee stock ownership plan, and we executed that plan. We just finished in November of this year doing the next third.
And so the rules of an ESOP are that it's those ownership shares go to all of your employees, correct?
That's correct.
It's not so that's a huge difference when you go from a very small ownership group to everyone owning something.
That's true, but we find that as we look at the next generation, we look at the current generation. We want people to be loyal, and we want people to stay.
Mm-hmm.
We also believe that absentee owners for construction companies don't work.
Mm-hmm.
The owners take an interest in what they're doing. So everybody in the company who qualifies, who's a full-time employee, participates in the ESOP, and we have an outside administrator that goes through that formula, which if you ask me to explain, I could not explain.
Way too complicated.
Way too complicated. But the fact of the matter is that it gives me a lot of joy to sit down with a common laborer. And when we've had several retire since we had the ESOP, but they have a decent retirement that they can depend upon in their latter years. That was not always the case at Benning Construction Company. There were many, many folks that I grew up with in the firm that when they retired, they'd spend every dime they'd spend on the way up. But we always used to joke that long-term planning for a construction worker is about 14 days.
So you've really changed the dynamic with that. I loved something you had on your history part of your website that said, related by purpose, not blood. And I thought that was a really interesting way to describe the power of an ESOP. Mm-hmm. Have you seen that to be a case from both a personal commitment as well as a retention tool, that there's been benefits from the ESOP?
There's no doubt that there are benefits from the ESOP, but it takes a certain type of person that wants to participate in an ESOP. One of our clients who we do a lot of work with is one of the largest ESOPs around, And we've watched how they run their ESOP and how that ESOP works. And they've consulted with us. I don't want to say consulted. That's probably the wrong word. We've given each other friendly over coffee advice. They said a key element to any ESOP working effectively is that you have to have loyalty and you have to have integrity in the process and you have to have people who embrace being honest.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Honorable people, I guess, is the best term. So we find that as we attract more honorable people, the ESOP...
Interesting. Well, and you had a great place to start from your existing employee mm-hmm. base as well. You never would have probably considered it had you not felt that about your team already. Well,
that's right. And we've got a great team. And every generation does business with itself.
Mm-hmm.
My dad and my grandfather had certain clients who, when they attempted to migrate them to me and to my team, we kind of looked at them like they were crazy. And some of those are still around and some of them aren't. We found our own set of clients to work with, and we've had a good time.
Yeah.
Now the next generation's coming up, and we're trying to hand off some accounts to them, and they're looking at us like I used to look at my dad.
Well, you know, it's incredible just the projects that you've done over the years. Toco Hills, Publix, Kmart's, you know, really kind of all over the place. The district at Howe Mill and 75, some of the real gems of our city have been, you know, at your hands, and I'm sure as you go to Raleigh or other places in the Southeast, that's the case as well. But talk about a project that you're either doing right now or that you're recently completed that you're particularly proud of.
I think probably the project that we're most proud of is a project in Athens, Georgia, called Epps Bridge. We're doing that for a fantastic customer who we have known for, good Lord, I want to say probably 15 or 16 years. We originally walked the property in 2001, and we started construction in 2012.
Now, that's a long sales cycle.
That ended up being a 72-acre mixed-use development, big-box power center, shopping center that we started in May of 2012, and we're getting ready to do the next phase starting next month. So that job will end up being somewhere around a half a million square feet of space before we're through. It's brought a really neat new addition to the Athens-Oconee County area on that side of town.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say that the client and our firm, the architectural firm, we work so closely and so well together on the firm that it really became a fun project for everybody involved, and it continues to be so.
So both of your businesses are really, in many ways, has a leading indicator aspect of things, or front loading it on the economy. It sounds like you've experienced, Ted, some feels like things are getting a little bit more positive out there over the last couple of years, and the momentum's building. Is that a fair statement? And observations on the current business environment?
I think that's a fair statement. Our volume of work, which is sort of a construction key indicator, we did 30% of the volume of work in 2009 that we did in 2008.
Wow.
And our levels right now is that we're getting closer to where we were in 2004, 2005 from a volume point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Although work is easier to obtain, I think the execution phase is as difficult as it's ever been. So there's a risk-reward right now, which creates some tension. Is it better? Yes, it's better that there's more work. Is it better from a risk point of view? No.
So really, again, highlighting the importance of knowing your company's capabilities and being smart about how you go after business.
That's right.
Chip, same thing with your business. There is this element of, you know, when you're going hard and heavy, it has signals for the overall economy. Thoughts on where we're going?
They can't make trailers fast enough right now.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. We have a standing order with a very large national carrier, and they want 250 trailers, and we're doing everything we can to fill that order. And that's just one order, mm-hmm. and it's long term. So. They did not manufacture many trailers during the recession, so the used trailer market, there's not many out there, and so we're having to fill in with some new. The business model doesn't work nearly as well with new, but we're having to fill in to continue to satisfy customer needs. But again, they can't make them fast enough.
So there's this catch-up phase, either from a talent in your side, Ted, or an actual equipment standpoint in yours, Chip, that's hard to manage. How do you manage that process? I guess it's just really kind of knowing your company well enough to know when's time to step on the gas and when is the time to, you know, stay in neutral for a little bit.
Yeah, I think sort of like what Ted's done this for many, many years, and you can almost feel it coming, mm-hmm. and we can sort of feel it coming, and you sit down and start projecting. We're actually doing our budgets now for next year. We're a little behind getting it finished, but you know, this year we were up 36%, and next year I think we'll be up at least that much, and you just know it's coming. And,
yeah.
I don't even know
you
how to
you just kind of build the infrastructure behind it and keep moving forward.
I hate to do this because, you know, we learned so many lessons during the last recession, but we're starting to say things like build it and they will come, you know.
Never say that.
I know. And that's just pure speculation, but
right.
It's going so fast right now. That's what we're doing. We're just saying, all right, well, let's be smart about this. Let's buy every used trailer that makes sense to buy, and let's fill in with some new. We used to never pre-buy. You know, a big client would have to come to us and say, I need this many trailers in this dimensions, and we'd go find it now.
What are some of the key learnings for you, Chip, through the downturn? I forgot what you just called it, Ted, but I like that.
The Great Reset.
The Reset, yeah.
Great Reset.
So thankfully we have resetted, past tense, but thoughts on things that you carry with you as business learnings through that time.
Oh, my gosh, there's so many. It would take a whole radio show to go over them, but the biggest thing is don't get extended out there with your debt too much.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is make sure you've got enough, you know, business volume to be able to take yourself through it.
Mm-hmm.
And then your people have got to know that you're close to the vest and you cut costs just as fast going down as you do going up. Mm-hmm. And you've got to stay on top of it.
Thoughts on that, Ted?
I think right now we're seeing that the clients are behind on understanding what the market conditions are.
Mm-hmm.
So where a client was used to driving a fairly hard deal during the Great Reset, they said, well, we can always get it, you know, done a little bit cheaper if we get a few more prices or if we do this or if we do that. The price will be cheaper. Now what they're finding out is cheap prices are up.
Mm-hmm.
Schedules are longer. And they don't like that. Whether they should like it or ought to like it, doesn't make any difference. We're finding that several of the clients, many of the tenants that we do in the retail side, are probably running 2.5 to 3 years behind what the market conditions truly are.
Hmm.
And they will learn by folks saying no, and they are getting a lot of no's right now.
So there's a bit of a power shift that's may not be the right word, but I guess that helps to improve your profitability or at least your scheduling and backlog a bit by having a little bit more
Well,
power.
I think the challenges are expectation management. Mm-hmm. When we are doing forward projecting budgets, as an example, Epps Bridge, we started budgeting the job in 2001. We did a lot of budgets.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, we're telling our customers, please don't base your performers on old data. Get mm-hmm. current data.
Mm-hmm.
Not only on cost, but who we're actually going to be building for. What are the specifications of these buildings? How have our tenants changed what they are looking for? Retail market's in a lot of change right now due to going from clicks to bricks and bricks to clicks and on down the line. So we're seeing actual sizes of stores shrink. The number of departments don't shrink. The ingredients within the store don't shrink, but the building shrinks. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, the cost per square foot goes up. They're basing numbers on old data. Immediately, the performance is going to be wrong.
Right.
And the margins in the development cycle are very, very thin, too, due to low interest rates on loans. So everybody has gotten hooked up to, quote, low costs, that world's shifting. My fear, truly, long-term, is that we'll get into an inflationary cycle that is exacerbated by high interest rates. We saw that after 74, 75, when business after business, it was over-leveraged. When interest rates went up, they went out of business. Most folks can't even remember.
Right.
74, 75, but I remember very vividly several of our friends in Atlanta going out of business because they had performed a business model on a 5% borrowing rate, and it went up over 8.
Right.
And they were out of business. The amount of leverage that's out there right now is extreme. It's going to be very, very interesting to see what happens if we get into a high interest rate market or a higher interest rate market.
Right, again, and that's, you know, sometimes you have to reinvent in every five years. Sometimes it's every 5 months, mm-hmm. and, you know, we may very well be going into that cycle. You both had the opportunity to work with your fathers, and there are a lot of business owners who are listeners who either are managing through or beginning to think about a transition from a parent. What advice would you have to our listeners around either working with a parent who's in the business or managing through that transition process? Chip, thoughts on that?
My first thought is I've got a child. I've got a son who's 21 years old, and he might come into the family business. And our rule is, which was different for me, I came right straight out of college into the family business. In his case, I've told him that, no, he has to go be successful somewhere else first. And our definition of success, get a job and earn a promotion before he can come into the family business. He's got to learn, you know, the work ethic. I think that there is a tendency to maybe think there's a little bit of a free ride there. And I know in my case, the family business, they were harder on me because I was a family member. My son has probably had to experience that a little bit, but I want him to go outside the family business and earn his wings and be promoted, be successful before he comes in.
Great advice. Thank you, Ted.
Well, I think it's important for the protege, let's call it the next generation to be called the protege, and let's call the older family member the founder.
Mm-hmm.
There's a dynamic there which is psychological in nature. Kennesaw State University's got a wonderful family business program that has studied that at length.
Joe Astrakhan and all those guys over there, will do a shout-out to them because they're doing great research and work on the whole family business concept.
But there's a family dynamic that does not exist in a publicly traded company, and that has to be respected.
Mm-hmm.
It even, I think, has to be appreciated. It is hard for a protege when things are tougher than they maybe should be or feel that they should be to respect the process that they're going through. There's also a negotiation that has to occur that is both business and psychological for it to be successful. The more that that is examined, discussed, and handled in a non-emotional way, I think the better the outcome. My sisters and I own joint property in another company outside of Benning Construction Company. And before my father's death, we spent untold numbers of afternoons on the back porch going through scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was we wanted to discuss in the cool of the evening, so to speak,
right,
the what-ifs before we got into the emotional situation of dealing with an estate or dealing with other family members. And I'm happy to report that we probated my dad's entire estate 3 years ago without a crossword between any of us.
Mm.
That to me is important. The concept of harmony within the business is important.
Well, and it's an incredible point you make around sometimes that ends up as a formal legal arrangement. But it's really those informal conversations or the connectedness between the family members or the generations that really creates the really strong plan. You know, what ends up as good planning oftentimes just happens through conversation.
Yeah, I think another thing that happens is that you find out what family members you need to boot out. And there are some family members you don't want a relationship with, and some of them are despicable.
Right.
And so you look at those, you take it for what it is, and you say, you know, I like old Aunt so-and-so, but, mm-hmm. You know, I really don't want to have a business relationship there because
right.
it won't.
It's not productive.
It won't be successful, and it's not productive. Mm-hmm. Last but not least, I think with our own, with my wife and I's two children, the opportunity to say, you don't have to do this. This is your choice. Mm-hmm. It's your life. Make the best of your life. Be good. The world needs good college professors. Good. The world needs good over-the-road drivers. It needs all kinds of good people working in various places. If construction is where that is for you, great. If it's something else, good. But do it well. Mm-hmm. Do it honestly and well, and you'll be successful at it. And I think family members need to be given that freedom.
You both have provided some incredible advice for business owners today. I want to turn the tables a little bit and ask you, what's the best advice you ever received? Chip.
Oh, boy. Nothing like putting me on the spot. Best advice I ever received. Whatever you do, have attention to detail.
That's great. And particularly in your business, which is about logistics and planning and pre-scheduling. Yeah. But it's great for life, too. Thank you. Attention to detail. Yep. Ted, thoughts?
I think probably three items there. The first was, don't cross a bridge that you just burned down. Cross a bridge before you burn it down. If you're going to burn down bridges, be sure you're over the bridge. I think that's number one.
Okay.
Number two, Overton Curry, a Smicker and Hancock, which was one of the first firms that really got involved in construction contracts back in the 70s, gave the advice, don't hide behind your contracts. Mm. You won't solve problems by pulling out the contract and hitting people with it. You solve problems by meeting with people, going over what the problems are and getting them solved. And that the last thing you should do is pull the contract out.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like that was really, really great advice that I got as an early worker in the business. And last but not least, embrace your 3 o'clock courage.
Now, what do you mean by that, 3 o'clock courage?
Well, 3 o'clock courage is when you wake up at 3 a.m. and you second guess yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And you're worried about the decisions that you've made, or things are on your back, as we like to call it. I always keep a pad by my bed. And when I wake up at 3 a.m, I write down whatever it is. And to embrace that and to realize that leadership does at times create fear.
Mm-hmm.
And that fear is normal, that it should be expected. And to embrace it, to look at it for what it is, and to courageously push through your decisions. Because any good leader, if you study leadership, every night Grant used to wake up at 3 o'clock, and he wanted to talk to Sherman. Not that I like either one of them, mind you, being from Atlanta.
Right.
But the fact of the matter was that Grant was forever second-guessing himself on whether he was doing the right thing. When he saw the cost in life and property that the Civil War was costing the Union, it kept him up.
I think this is true for every founder, for every entrepreneur, for every business owner, regardless of age, is there is that 3 o'clock element. I talk about a area of my den that's a little bit more run down from a rug standpoint, because that's where I pace back and forth at 3 o'clock in the morning thinking about one or two different things. And it's a different thing every night. And thank you for that advice, both of you. But that advice around running towards the fear, running towards the challenge or issue, and really kind of taking the time to embrace that and understand it, and then go solve it, which is ultimately what every business owner does all the time, which is just solve issues with their team. We're gonna move into what I like to call the speed round. This is where I just kind of ask you some fun questions. You both are such thoughtful leaders. Would love to get your perspective on a great book or business resource that you've recently or that you really count on or go back to. Chip?
I'm going to try and make this short and sweet. My poor kids just went through this, but I actually wrote a term paper and listed my footnotes and did it all right and sat down last Christmas and went through it and said, here's the reality of life that you're getting ready to go to. I'm not sure that you were raised in that exact reality, but here's the reality, and it's hard work, and the world out there is tough. It's not as easy as you think it is. You've lived in the house. You've lived under mom's, you know, cooking and cleaning and doing all these other things and going to colleges and having a car to drive. But here's the realities of life. And after I was through, I gave them all a copy of Dave Ramsey's Total Money Makeover, and it teaches you about budgeting and managing money. And I said, for me to fund your next college semester, you have to read the book and call me and tell me what you think about it. And you've got 4 months to do it. And they all did. And are they all doing budgets today? No, they're not. But I know they all picked up a lot out of that book. So that's the one book I really highly recommend.
Fantastic. Thank you.
There's so many books that could be recommended. I tend to maybe go a little bit different direction. I think that the best books are the books that have absolutely nothing to do with business, mm-hmm. That are outside of the realm of business and business acumen, that bring points of view that may be radical or different, to challenge existing assumptions. I find them to be interesting. I think that whether that be Tolkien or whether that be Stephen King or whether that be someone else.
Autobiographies or biographies are sometimes useful in that way, too.
That's true. And some of those are even true.
Mm-hmm. That's great. What about areas of interest from a charitable perspective or organizations that you really believe in?
Me first?
Sure.
I'm very passionate about an organization that's run by a lady here in Atlanta by the name of Lauren Winborn. The name of the firm is called SteerSmart. The largest single killer of teenagers is distracted driving. And it's not alcohol related, and it is not drug related. It is absolutely just distracted driving. And Lauren Winborn, in her own way, with her husband, goes around to schools and puts on a video and teaches kids about distracted driving. And it's a wonderful organization that I've just recently gotten involved in.
And that truly saves lives every year.
Truly saves lives.
That's great. Ted?
I know for us that we have as part of our common review of financial information is that all of our folks are taught that we're going to take a certain amount that we make as a company and we're going to give it away each year. We traditionally give away those funds as anonymous donors, and we ask never to be added to a list or to be contacted, and we send the money out the door, which we're happy to do. The only exception that we really made to that, there have only been a couple, Good Samaritan Health Center, which is down on Hollowell Parkway in Atlanta, does a wonderful work, and we have supported them publicly for a number of years and will continue to do so because they're bringing health care to folks in Atlanta who have the lowest opportunity or the least opportunity to have good health care.
Right. And one other question on that. So that's something at a firm-wide level that you bring everyone into the decision-making process around where those funds are going to go. That's got to be powerful from a team-building standpoint as well, I would think.
Well, I don't think – I mean, that may be a side benefit. Mm-hmm. I think you get what you give. Mm-hmm. And if you you can give out bad stuff, you get bad stuff back. You give out good stuff comes back. I think that's kind of one of those rules in the universe.
Right.
So we've been fortunate. We've had what on a Wall Street basis would be modest business success. But we certainly haven't missed any meals, and we've certainly had good lives. And so we need to pay attention to that. And there's been a reason that's happened, and we need to give some of it back.
That's great. Thank you both for being on Founders Club this week. It's just been great to catch up with both of you. I'd like to ask for our listeners a way for them to learn more about your business or contact you directly. Chip?
The trailer business is rentdst.com, and Airvan is airvaninc.com, and AVI is avilogisticssolutions.com.
Fantastic. Thank you. Ted?
Well, our phone number, since I'm old and we still use those things, is 404-792-1911. And anybody who wants to give a call, I'm at extension 223. Certainly happy to take the call. My email address is trbiii@benningnet.com. And our website is www.benningnet.com, and we'd welcome any inquiries or comments.
Excellent. Thank you both. This has been a lot of fun. Join us again next week for another Founders Club broadcast sponsored by Atlantic Capital Bank and powered by Business Radio X.